I have to tell the people about the Patreon.
Yes, you do. Patreon.com/SMDB. SMDB, like so many damn books.
For just a dollar, you can join up and you get access to all the exclusive content that I record just for the Patreon. Also, you get to join the book club. Many damn books book club. It's been some of the best conversations I've had about books.
It really always sounds like a blast. I'll usually like come home and just hear like giggles coming from the library. So it's a great time. You should join.
And I would love to have more people join the fray.
You may or may not know that Christopher runs this whole show himself on the hosting side, on the technical side, everything. This is a one-man show, truly. He does it all. Support your boy, Christopher.
Even at the dollar level really helps. So join up, patreon.com/SMDB. I'd love to have you.
Patreon.com/SMDB.
On with the show. Oh, before we start, actually, do you mind if we take the picture for the internet?
Yes, the internet. Am I supposed to hold a book or just hang out?
Just hang out. All right, thank you.
Sick.
I always forget. And so I'm like, take the picture first because it's before y'all talked out.
Before you get all frazzled, you know? Yeah,
I get very frazzled.
Before we're screaming at each other.
Yeah, this is book yelling, right? The podcast.
Yeah, we're still on good terms, you know?
So many damn books.
Hello out there in listener land. This is So Many Damn Books, a blessing, a curse, a podcast. And I am Christopher, the host of this show. And I'm joined in the Zoom version of the damn library by Jenna Rose Nethercutt. Back. For a second round.
Woohoo!
I'm so glad you could join me.
Thanks.
Jenna Rose, if you haven't met her yet, is the author of Thistlefoot, the amazing novel, which you came on the show to talk about, and then also the book-length poem, The Lumberjack's Dove. And now you're here to talk about your brand new short story collection, 50 Beasts to Break Your Heart.
Darn right I am. Can't get rid of me.
Why would I want to? Especially when you give me such good fodder for making a drink. But let's talk this cocktail, which I'm calling 50 Lemons to Disarm the Beasts. They were scary animals in here. So I was thinking, you know, after reading the bestiary, I wanted something with which to defend myself.
Naturally.
And I just feel like lemons, both as just a missile on its own, and then the lemon juice is just, you know, it's an acid. I feel like animals and most beings don't interact with them on purpose. So it's always a surprise. And so I was thinking of, I just wanted as much lemon in this as possible. So it's lemon juice, limoncello, lemon simple syrup, which you use lemon zest to in your sugar and leave it for a few hours before you turn it into simple syrup. And then I've been playing with saline solution recently. It's a really fun, just a little bit of salt and a lot of water, and using that to sort of, it brings up the, it somehow enhances all flavor just the way that salt usually does. So that with an egg white in this, it's a sour recipe. And I'm absolutely in love with it because it's kind of got a lemon meringue pie feel, which is one of my absolute favorite pies. And I feel like this would it would maybe even put you on good terms with any beasts that you saw if you just serve this to them. You don't even have to start by attacking.
I love that. More of a taming them.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, with a damn good cocktail. Mm-hmm. It looks fantastic. I can see the little cup, the egg white. I'm a sucker for an egg white cocktail. Something
always.
About as soon as the egg white goes on, you're like, oh, this is legit now. Like, we are not playing around.
And it is one of those things that I was very apprehensive about doing egg white at home. And it's totally easy and not a big deal. And if you want to try egg white at home, you should definitely go for it. But, you know, you just shake things dry without any ice for a bit longer, just as the egg white, to give it the time to sort of foam up before you try to cool it down and break it all apart with ice.
Got it. The way that you like wilt a kale with lemon juice.
So that's the cocktail, 50 lemons to disarm the beast. There, if you want to see the cocktails, just all the cocktails, you can go to somanydamnbooks.com and look at the damn bar and see hundreds of cocktails that I have made, including the one that I made the last time for you that included smoke. I forgot
That was
how
magical, yeah.
I forgot how crazy I'd gone for that. That was fun though. Cheers. Do you have anything fun to be drinking?
What I have been drinking, though, I'll re retroactively cheers you, is I have a new favorite scotch, which is Lafroig Quarter Cask. I don't know if you've had that one, but it is incredible, and it's like become my new go-to.
What does quarter cask mean?
So they're aged in like quarter-sized casks, like small casks, which means that there is more surface area of wood that the whiskey is touching, which then, instills it with a kind of woodier, peatier experience than you would have if it was aged in a more traditional, like larger production, big cask. So tiny casks for fun and that's a tour of delight.
Yeah, I mean, I want to see all the tiny casts. I want to see the little ones next to the big ones, you know?
Yeah,
I
who
feel like that'd
wouldn't?
be really cute.
People love a little thing next to a big thing.
That's just true.
That's just telling it like it is. And you always say, oh, look, it's a baby one. You know?
You have to. I think it's
It's the law,
required. It's
actually. Most people don't know that, but like it's on the books. Kind of like if you are watching Lord of the Rings and you don't say, oh, Viggo Mortensen broke his toe when he kicked the helmet. Like, you go to jail if you don't say that.
One law of this show, see
Great
the
segue.
segue, is that what did you buy comes after the I prattle on about the cocktail. Did you buy anything good recently?
I've really enjoyed ending up in that like 2 a.m. fugue state where I suddenly decide that I like need a book where all the paper is made of sticker paper so you can t stick your stickers to it and rem you know it's just like chaotic per never mind. I've bought my latest excitement was in one of these 2 a.m. fugue states where I'm like I need to purchase something just to feel, a classic late capitalist sensation. I bought all of these tiny little like charms, like little lucky charms. So I got a little horseshoe and like a little heart and all these little guys and then I kind of forgot how over the top I went until they arrived and like 30 tiny charms came in the mail. Which was kind of, it was like treasure, like a tiny little treasure. And then the other thing that is more replicatable is I just got Kelly Link's new book, The Book of Love,
Oh, that's
which
a
we have gushed over
doorstop.
her together before. So yeah, it's shiny and gilded and humongous and her very first novel. So I'm really, really stoked to read it.
Oh yeah, I was so excited when that arrived, and it is a total crazy maximalist thing.
I just got mine and I'm like waiting for a moment where I can just fully dedicate my whole brain to it.
Yes, I highly recommend that. I think, let it consume a weekend is what I would say. I got a book that I'm really excited to check out. It came out last year, last summer. It's called The Deep Sky by Yuma Kitase. And it's about a sort of last gasp of humanity rocket leaving Earth with 80 astronauts. And on the way, there's this explosion that kills three of them, and it sends them off course, and everybody needs to know, like, how did this explosion occur? And I love a locked room. I love a spaceship story. This seems totally up my alley. I'm very excited to check it out. And then one thing that I'm curious if you've heard of this book, by Melinda Taub, The Scandalous Confessions of Lydia Bennett, Witch, which is a Pride and Prejudice retelling from Lydia, the youngest sister's point of view, and she is a practicing witch. And apparently, the copy teases that Mr. Darcy also is a magician in this imagining.
Yes. That's like a blast.
Yeah, so I'm very excited to check this one out too. These are the two diametrically opposed almost
Yeah, it's
worlds.
good to have variety.
Yeah, I'm really excited about both of them.
I just saw I was when I was on tour last week, I stopped in Stanton, Virginia, where the American Shakespeare Center is, and I saw a show staged in there. They have this like reproduction Shakespearean theater, not the Globe, but one of his smaller theaters. And they were staging Pride and Prejudice. So I just saw a production of Pride and Prejudice there, and I just keep thinking like, ah, oh, yes, Shakespeare's classic, Pride and Prejudice.
It might not be one of his, but that's well, you've been on tour for your new short story collection, 50 Beasts to Break Your Heart. What are you doing for your tour this time? I feel like you did a big puppet show for Thistlefoot. Are you reading a story? Are you performing?
I know, I really set the bar a little high, you know? And it took some real mental gymnastics on my part to convince myself not to do that again. But I was very tired, you see. And it was like, no puppets this time, Jenna. You're not allowed to bring puppets. And okay, to be fair, I did not bring puppets. That said, I did bring life-size hand-painted cutouts of monsters that stand on stage with me as I read. Which wasn't my fault. It's kind of like the cat distribution system. They find you. Like, these monsters found me. I was at my friend Sophia DiMatteo's studio, art studio, and they were working on a project. They were like, oh, look, I've been painting this. And it's literally like a photorealistic cutout, life-size cutout of an invented creature. And I was like, okay, well, I'm gonna need to rent these from you. So yeah, I indulged in Sophia's monster rental service and have three of these monsters, three at the launch, two that I take on the road with me. I call them Jonathan and Horace, and they are absolute abominations. So yeah, I have set dressings. Otherwise, I either read a full story or I kind of popcorn style read from a few stories. The structure of a number of the stories in the book are told kind of in a conglomerate of prose poems, for lack of a better description, and so they lend themselves well to kind of excerpting and popcorning between them. So yeah. Just a reading, but a reading with pizzazz. Oh, also, I had like cursed Valentines that I would hand out to people that had images of the beasts on them and pithy little phrases. Because in the book, one of my favorite things about the book is that all of the beasts are fully illustrated. The titular story, 50 Beasts to Break Your Heart, is in the form of a mythical bestiary, like an encyclopedia of these creatures. And every single one of the 50 of them are illustrated by my friend Bobby Detrani. Who I think you guys read Lyanna Fled the Cranberry Bog, right? Same
Yeah, something that you
illustrator.
don't even mention in your bio, even though it's one of my
It's
favorite
so great.
things.
I know. There's too many projects.
That
Too many
is
damn
for the people
projects.
who don't know, that's your cootie catcher story told in cootie catchers that you fold yourself. And yeah, mine's somewhere right behind me.
Yeah, so that same illustrator, it's as you know, a fully illustrated 26 Cootie Catcher project. That same artist, Bobby Detrani, is the illustrator who drew my beasts, which, and this is a fun little Easter egg I like to tell people, for those who read Thistlefoot, you know how the Duskbreaker Band and Thistlefoot, they travel on this spray painted black school bus? That's also just Bobby's school bus that his band tours in. So
So that's just a real thing that you just borrowed and threw in
Yeah,
there.
it's kind of I shocking, embarrassing, revealing, who knows how much of the things I just steal from my friends and put in my books.
I feel like there's people around you who are recognizing like little bits and pieces, and it's not story maybe, but it's detail.
Definitely, yeah. I mean, and I think all writers do that. You know, nothing exists in a vacuum. Stories are built from all these little quilt pieces that we gather from our lives. So, but I think it's fun to point them out and see how secretly all these projects actually kind of weirdly exist in the same universe. I guess that universe being my brain.
I want to hear more about putting together the bestiary. Did the writing come first, I assume, and then that's how the animals were illustrated, or did you ever try one the other way?
Yeah, so I actually first started working on the beasts about, I think it must have been like 8 or 9 years ago. And I had the idea for it. I always wanted it to be illustrated. And actually the very first one I wrote, which was the seed vulpus, which is the little fox asleep inside a pomegranate that's like born from a pomegranate. That was the first one I wrote, and a friend of mine, a different friend of mine, illustrated it. And that was just like kind of a little standalone thing. And I was like, let's keep going. I want to keep doing these. Like, I want to write a whole book of these. And so I started doing that. And I was like, come on, catch up. And she wasn't on board.
Right.
And so she did not have the same kind of verve that I did for the project. So I wrote it. I wrote it as a collection. Originally in my head, it was kind of, it would be to be published like a poetry collection. But no one would just, take a standalone 50-page bestiary. And so, but I loved it and I held on to it for years and years in the form that it was in, and published little bits of it here and there, but just as text. But in my heart, I always wanted it to be illustrated. And so when I finally put the collection together, which includes a total of 14 stories, the bestiary being one of them, I kind of like hoped that we could get illustrations for it, but I didn't think it would happen. And then kind of at the last minute, I was like, hey, you guys want to let my friend Bob illustrate these? And, Vintage was on board and supported it and commissioned him. And it was, yeah, dream come true. So, and what was really cool about it too, seeing those illustrations, was I'd had these creatures in my head. These are all invented creatures, mind you. These are not pre-existing animals from either life or myth. They're all like weird little guys I made up. And so these were creatures that I had pretty vividly in my head for many years, almost a decade, by the time Bobby laid his hands on them. And so then to see his renditions of them, and see what these looked like in someone else's imagination was really exciting and very upsetting. Not because I wasn't happy with them, but because they are very creepy little guys.
Did you want to art direct at all, or did they look kind of exactly right, or what did it any like have to go back to the drawing board?
There were one or two that we had him edit, either because they like weren't quite weird enough. Like there were a couple where I was like, that just looks like a regular bird. You got to make that bird freakier.
Good note.
But that for the most part, not a problem for him. And then, so there's a through thread in this story, which is about these florists who are the ones writing this bestiary, conducting this field research on these creatures, with the theory that maybe you can make a bouquet out of animals, not just flowers. And so it's this kind of doomed love affair between these florists that you're following throughout the story in these little bits and bobs. And that through thread did not exist yet when Bob illustrated the beasts. There was an original through thread that was just worse, and so I cut it and wrote an entirely new one. And so, like the final one, there once in a while you kind of see a glimpse of these florists in the imagery. And so those had to be redone. Those had to be added in later because when he first illustrated them, they didn't exist.
It reminded me this shape of using, a catalog to sneak a plot in reminded me of Leanne Chapin's book, Important Artifacts. Do you know this
No,
book?
but that sounds great.
It's told through an auction catalog of a couple's items, and you realize that it's the auction catalog to their sort of relationship
Oh, I love
throughout,
that.
someone's like t-shirt that they wore like 40 times, like that sort of intimate detail in the auction guide. And it reminded me, it's just one of my favorite forms. I just like loved seeing it applied to a bestiary of completely made up animals.
I love a story seen like in periphery.
Yes. Yeah.
That I find that really exciting, where the focus is on something that almost seems bland or insignificant, and out of the corner of your eye, you can actually like watch the action taking place.
Yeah, I feel like you do that in other places in this as well. I feel like fables can be like that, where you're looking at the wild detail of it and the secret meanings and magic of it are in the periphery.
Totally. And I think like a well done metaphor functions that way too, where you're not hitting someone over the head with it, though I frequently do hit people over the head with a metaphor. I'm not too good for that. But I think when they're done most deftly, it's that little bit of sugar with the medicine, where you have that metaphor kind of just like slip in like a ghost underneath whatever your focus is being taken up by. Almost like a subliminal messaging in a way.
Speaking of ghosts, there's a great ghost story in here of boyfriend sort of making d do with a girlfriend's ghost instead of the girlfriend, kind of. I feel like everything in you're interested in things that are haunting but not scary.
Yes, that's true.
Looking at the emotion behind a haunting.
I've always said that like I'm less interested in what a monster says about monsters and much more interested in what a monster says about people. And I feel like with ghost stories in particular, they're such a form of longing. They're an entire genre that is all about lack and absence and yearning for something so strongly that it manifests. And I have always maintained that the definition of a ghost is a manifestation of want. Whether that be for a person who is gone, or you've got, I have an essay about this actually, that was in Lit Hub a couple of years ago, where it was, I talk about how like in Hamlet he sees his father, and it's this like manifestation of like wanting his father back. And then in Rebecca, she manifests Rebecca all around her, as this manifestation of like wanting acknowledgement and wanting to be Rebecca and be in this space. And really, I think that a ghost doesn't have to have anything to do with death. It has to do with lack. And that lack, in the way that we feel it as human beings, missing someone or something, or just the sensation of longing and yearning, we talk about it as an absence, but it's really a presence. It's something you have to maneuver around in your life. It is something that manifests all around you and becomes this obstacle around which you have to kind of tiptoe in order to function. And that, I mean, what is that if not a ghost,
You could say that this is like a book of hauntings if you're trying to make sentences up about the book that are trying to contain it all, which is a
Sure.
fun exercise, I guess.
And I do think of the book like, the way I describe it in terms of what the common thread pulling the stories together, unifying the stories is that they're all about yearning. Every one of these stories is an exploration of some facet of longing, and how it either serves as like a weapon that can wound or as a medicine that can heal, depending on how it's approached and dealt with and wielded. So yeah, so if yearning, or if ghosts are yearnings and yearnings are ghosts, then every one of these stories could arguably be a ghost story because each of them does contain a yearning.
Were you thinking about that when you were putting this together from the very beginning? Or I'd like to hear more about this, the gathering process, or how many of these stories were written in the post-Thistlefoot world.
So these stories actually are almost entirely pre-Thistlefoot. The collection was complete when we sold Thistlefoot on spec, but they wanted the novel to come out first and the stories to come out second. So we just kind of held onto it and waited. And the only story that was written post-Thistlefoot is The War of Fog. Other than that, every single one of the stories was written pre-Thistlefoot, and the earliest of the stories was written 12 years ago. That is a story called Foxjaw, and most recent one is War of Fog, which was written just about a year ago. And the majority of the stories were written in 2018 when I was on tour for the Lumberjack's Dove. So I would drive all day in my little Honda Fit that I'd tricked out with a camper in the trunk and a little puppet theater. And I would just like drive across America doing puppet shows, reading from this book of poetry because I cannot do a reading in a normal way, though I'm getting better. Only little monsters this time. But yeah, so I'd do that all day. I'd do a reading, schmooze with booksellers, pull my little Honda Fit over on in front of a dive bar somewhere, and then I would curl up in the little bed in the trunk and I would write a story. And so that was how the majority of them were born.
One of my favorite ones is structured as a list of methods of divination, and but it's actually, witchy story about a group of friends who hate the new girl. I just wanted to know more about the writing of that story.
Well, first, I was a teen middle school girl, and it was rough. And then I was like, well, I guess I'll just carry this youthful trauma around forever, or I could turn it into a story and make something of myself. So yeah, this is basically my processing middle school trauma story. Was I a new girl who moved to a new town and got weirdly bullied? What would make you think something like that? I love the story. It's one of my favorites in the collection. It's in an abecedarium, so it's an ABCs of different kinds of divination. And it, yes, was a stretch to find a means of divination that fit every letter of the alphabet, but I did it. And thanks Wikipedia for that one. One of the things I find really fun about this story is how real so much of it is. It seems like this very hyperbolic, magical, strange story, but like when I was in middle school, the girls really did entertain themselves at recess by pressing on each other's hearts behind the dodgeball wall until they passed out. And then when they came to, like asking them what they saw. Like that shit's just what we were up to back then. And yeah, it was really interesting to kind of revisit this period of my life that I've really shut in a box and was so long ago. And just, middle school mean girls everywhere. But I love a constraining form. I think as a poet coming from the world of poetry where we're taught that and we know that like constraint breeds creativity when you have to write a sestina or a sonnet or what have you, and it kind of frees your imagination up. I love confining myself to a form. And so having to constrain myself to just writing in these definitions of, or these different versions of divination, I think was really fun for me, a really natural way for my brain to work.
Do you have any short story idols?
Oh, yeah. Oh, my God. I mean, this is why I'm so excited about this book coming out, is because all my favorite writers are short story writers. Short stories are the genre that moves me more than any other genre. And so, to have my first collection of short stories coming out after publishing as a poet, after publishing as a novelist, after publishing as a weird cootie catcher goblin, I feel like this is me throwing my hat into the ring with my heroes. And we've talked about Kelly Link. She's obviously the creme de la creme. She's my favorite writer. She like broke my whole brain the first time I read her, rewired my entire being. I think that this collection too carries a lot of influence from like Angela Carter, Karen Russell, Amy Bender, Ray Bradbury, Sophia Samatar. I only read after writing most of the stories in this collection, but I read her short story collection Tender fairly recently, and it was one of these books that I couldn't get through because I kept every time I'd finish a story, I'd like throw it across the room and I'd be like, it's too good. Not allowed. So yeah, Sophia Samatar. Yeah, that's my main crew, I would say.
Yeah, I mean, I felt that. I felt Amy Bender in this with Thread Boy, because that's sort of like using a fable to explore a facet of human relationships that has maybe gone unexplored.
I think that there was some direct Amy Bender influence in that story in particular, actually. So that makes sense. I think I was in Thread Boy, which is about a boy who's made of thread, kind of journeying through the world. I had recently read the story about the boy with the iron for a head,
Oh,
which
yeah.
I love that story. And then he like ends up in the store, in like the store, like with all the irons on the shelves, and is just like staring up at them.
Yeah.
That's good stuff.
I was thinking of also the boy with the with 10 keys per fingers, and they
Oh,
all
I forgot
open.
all about that one. That was a good one. And he's trying to find where they fit. Yes.
Yes. Yeah,
Man.
they open the 10 thing most important things in his life.
Ugh, that's so good.
That's so
She's so
much fun.
smart.
So, I mean, this to me is the next natural question, which is, what do you think are some elements of like a good short story?
I mean, I think I have very particular taste in short stories that not everyone agrees with, but I really think the short stories that I love are a feeling, not a plot. I don't really care about plot in short story. I don't care about an ending. I don't care. What I care about is like, I want just like to feel a sensation. And so that's why I love the work of all of those fabulous writers where it almost feels like waking up from a dream that you only half recall, and you're left with a feeling, but you're not quite sh you can't quite put your finger on what caused that feeling, and I love that. I think that's so magical and so masterful to be able to conjure in a person, as opposed to someone being able to be like, oh, I know what this story is about. I would rather someone be like, I feel a certain way, and I'm not quite sure how I feel about that. But in terms of what makes a good short story, yeah, I think it's almost like a lack of feeling the need to incorporate the sort of things that you might more often find in a novel. So not feeling the need to have everything explained and buttoned up, not feeling the need to have like a pat conclusion, not feeling the need to have like fully dredged out like characters and plot line, but instead to lean into how do I want someone to feel when they finish reading this?
So you're aiming for the feeling they have afterwards.
Yeah, and I think, you know, the way that I think of the mode that I write in, as well as the mode that I love to read in with those particular writers, is I really, and I've said this a number of times in various interviews, but I think of it as a turning up the volume knob on reality, on how it feels to be a person, which is kind of how I think of magical realism in general as a mode, in that, you know, the logic of the internal landscape becomes the logic of the external landscape, as opposed to the internal landscape saying one thing and the external landscape saying something else, and you have this chafing between what you feel and how the world responds to it. You are able to like fix that, kind of heal that, and make this like beautiful symmetry between the internal and the external.
Mending the dissonance. I like that. The book that you brought along with you, that you recommended, Sabrina Oromark's Happily, I feel like that's one thing that she's really trying to do in her own writing, is mending the dissonance of like real life versus fable. And she's truly like looking at that line
Oh,
throughout this
absolutely.
collection.
She's brilliant at this. And, you know, for those of you who haven't read this book, Happily, you may have read some of her essays. Particularly, there was one essay that's in this collection that went really viral during COVID, which was Fuck the Bread is Over.
Oh,
I don't know
yeah.
if y'all remember reading that one. But I th that was my introduction to her work, and I read it and I was just like, who is this and where can I find everything she's ever written? And in short, the way that she writes is she writes these essays. This book, Happily, is all essays. And they're nonfiction essays, but they use fairy tale as a parallel for all of these things that are happening in her personal life. So she explores motherhood and Judaism and, dealing with pandemic and dealing with familial illness and death and all of these different very everyday human struggles that she then finds these incredible parallels to in fairy tales and is able to process and explain them through various pre-existing fairy tales, which is why I love fairy tales. It's why I love folklore. It's because they're telling us stories about ourselves and they're allowing us to process our own life in a softer way.
While I was reading this, I was thinking about a children's book by John Sietzka called Math Curse. And it's funny that you use the word finding fables, because to me it seemed more like she's haunted, like that she is fully like looking around the world, and all she sees is fables of how they're playing out in her life,
Totally.
because like everything relates to a fable, from like how she's relating to her children, how she's relating to her husband, and like some of that feels like, yeah, a little bit of finding it, but a lot of it also feels like
It's just in
she
there,
knows it so well that she can't help. One that I'll point to specifically where I had that feeling was her excavation of Bluebeard, Bluebeard's castle, because that's such a, I feel like that fable is around right now. There was an Anna Biller novel, Bluebeard's Castle. She directed the Love Witch movie, and she wrote
Oh
this
my
great
God.
gothic
Wait, she
novel.
did a Bluebeard's castle? That must be bonkers.
It's a fun novel, yeah. It's and she's a third wife, Sabrina Ora Marx is, and so she's looking at that, and it has like a deeper resonance as she's thinking about it. And so yeah, I feel a curse.
Totally. Well, and I mean, one of the things that I love in writing is when you can see the very specific, very obsessive lens of a character or a writer. Like Maggie Nelson's Bluettes is the classic example of this, right? Where I call it the poetics of obsession, where someone becomes so deeply steeped in a particular like hyperfixation that it colors everything that they do and everything that they see is through the lens of that knowledge and passion and understanding. And when I write, I love to play with that. Like I had a I'm actually I'm working on a project right now where the protagonist is obsessed with perfumery. And so everything that she's experiencing in her life and everything that she sees, she kind of filters through the lens of fragrance and perfume history. And likens every experience to a different scent or a different ingredient in perfumery. And it's like how her memory works is all in perfumery. And I find that so human, I think, is I think about there's this episode of Radiolab about horseshoe crabs and about how horseshoe crabs have this blood that has like medical restorative kind of immortal properties that's used in pharmaceuticals, yada yada. But as part of this episode, they interview this guy who just like freaking loves horseshoe crabs so much that he like uprooted his life and he moved to the beach where horseshoe crabs mate every year just so that he could like be there and like look at horseshoe crabs every day. And to me, that's the poetics of obsession. And that's like kind of what being in Sabrina Ora Marx's mind is like in these two, where you're like, oh, this person's entire life, there's like this gravitational orbit around these stories. And I like this idea of, kind of likening it to mending the dissonance, because it does feel like she's making quilts in these essays to me, where the connections she's drawing between these things in her own life. Like you said, she's a third wife, and so naturally there's this connection to Bluebeard. And there's all of these different examples in the stories where there's some very specific thing in her life and some very specific thing in a fairy tale, and then she draws a thread between them, and it feels like she's stitching quilt pieces together in every single one of these. And it's marvelous to watch her do it. And also, I think just very much how my brain works too. So I find it really exciting to see someone doing it so deftly.
Yeah. And I have to say that I would number among the people who are a little bit mystified by the world of creative nonfiction, and what that is and what the genre can do. And this to me, I was like, oh, you know, this is
Yeah,
creative
absolutely.
nonfiction. Like this is it at its core. I mean, the last story, the last essay is so deeply a fable, that she's pulling from her own life. And yeah, I just I was very impressed by that because I guess I mean I think I've read it academically, but I feel like this was one of the first times that I've come across it just in a book that was recommended to me.
Well, glad to broaden your horizon.
Mm-hmm.
I really love the, I think that she's tapping into and kind of recreating the folkloric process in general, where the reason that these stories exist were because we needed ways to process the things that were happening around us. But so often, and honestly, this is why I love folklore in general, is that so often there are things that are either too frightening or too difficult or too taboo to talk about directly. And so rather than talk about directly, communities would come up with these elaborate, fantastical, metaphorical parallels for them. And those would allow us to process those emotions and discuss those taboos without revealing ourselves too brazenly. And those, you know, as a folklorist, that's the kind of folklore that really excites me. It's sort of like I say, more interested in what a monster says about people than what it says about monsters, is like the stories that we are telling reveal a lot about the things we're unwilling to say out loud. About the things that these stories have replaced. And I think that these essays of Marx are exactly that, except that she shows both of them. She isn't fully replacing the thing in life that the story is representing. She's like holding up these two matching items and comparing them to each other, and you could actually see them kind of vibrate against each other.
Yeah, and I think that that was like the most stark in the COVID work. So there's a couple pieces that are very much written in deep COVID, and I have to I don't I don't think I'm interested in reading COVID writing, or that's what I say. And then, you know, I think this was the one of the first times that I did enjoy reading some thoughts about COVID. And I think it's because she was presenting the details as a fable. And I think that only really works once. I think she I think this is the only time that this is going to, I don't think other people
No
can
one else can pull this off. Yeah, for
no.
sure.
But it did work great for this one essay, and yeah.
There's a mode of therapy where basically therapists, like this particular kind of therapy, I'm not actually sure what it's called, but the therapist is also an expert in folklore and fairy tales. And so sort of the job here is that you, it's a talk therapy. You like hear what issues the person's grappling with, what their experiences are, and then you find a fairy tale or a folk tale that parallels that experience, addresses that experience, and then you work on healing the trauma together through the fairy tale.
I feel like she has a piece that's like addressing that specifically with when her son decides he doesn't want to be Peter Pan for Halloween anymore. He wants to be Martin Luther King Jr. I just think that that's great. That's it in a and it's so that's a great like funny one. It's a little microcosm, and I would say like this book, I think we're talking about it in lofty terms, and it's not that it's not that academic as I think we might be
It's
making it
very fun. I
seem.
mean, yeah, it's very fun. It's very readable.
Oh yeah, and it's short.
Entertaining.
Yeah.
Yeah, they're funny, fun, entertaining stories, but I mean, I think all my favorite things to read are things that are just a blast, but then if you actually dig into what the writer is doing, you're like, oh, you are very smart.
Right. There's this great like she does this thing where she's sort of consideration she's doing a consideration of myth making, but she's doing it through like making her tooth fairy fable up for her kid,
Yeah.
and working that through.
I think that's kind of one of the things that's so fun about like about fairy tales and folklore and fabulous stories is that they do double in this way, as they're both just like a fun little time. They can be just taken as a fun time, a good story. But if you want to unpeel the layers, there are always new layers to unpeel.
I'm so glad that you recommended this to me. It was such a great, refreshing, fun way to think of, and I don't think I would have read this otherwise. So I'm so appreciative that you put it across my desk. And now I actually am curious if you have other recommendations for the good people.
Of the list that I gave earlier, like my favorite short story writers, I guess I'll just throw out a book from each of them that I'd recommend, because those are the ones that I recommend the most. That's like my key suggestions. If this mode of story is what really gets you going, or if you're curious about it, my favorite Kelly Link book is probably Magic for Beginners, though all of them are absolutely phenomenal. For, like I said, Tender by Sophia Samatar. Karen Russell has a ton of phenomenal books. I think Vampires in the Lemon Grove is probably what I would recommend as the starter. I really think she's a master in terms of short stories of setting. In all of her stories, setting is almost a character in itself in a way that's really, really interesting. Angela Carter, The Bloody Chamber. If you want a real good bluebeard, that's where to go for that. And those are all actual fairy tale retellings. And kind of, she's really the grandmother of the whole genre in a way. She was writing in the 1970s in England, these kind of sexualized feminist retellings of classic fairy tales. She was deeply misunderstood in her time. It was like the wave of feminism that were like, the only way you can be a feminist is to never be horny at all. And she was like, I don't think that's true. So yeah, she's really brilliant. And Bradbury is just, whatever he's doing is probably a good time. So my favorite, I love Something Wicked This Way Comes, which to be fair is a novel, not short stories. But that's my favorite of his. You can't go wrong with A Cursed Carnival. Also, in terms of, I'm really obsessed with this YA series by Libba Bray called The Diviners. It's teen psychic flappers fighting ghosts in 1920s New York City, but the real villain is eugenics.
Oh gosh.
It's the perfect example of a story that's like both a really, really good time and also like you can peel back the layers infinitely in it.
I remember another novel of hers that I really liked called Going Bovine.
Oh yeah.
Yeah.
Very different
Very,
tonally.
very different. Very different book.
Yeah, she rocks.
Amy Bender, that's your last. You
Oh
didn't
yes, Amy Bender. I would say The
curious what
Girl
your
with the
favorite
Flammable
is.
Skirt.
Yeah.
Yeah, Girl with the Flammable Skirt.
Nice. That's a good list. I love that. I'm going to recommend something as well. It's in a different sort of vein. I'm still up in space, I guess. This is I read Orbital by Samantha Harvey, which is about six astronauts on a space station. And it's basically six short stories because they're not really connected to one another. It's just more like they're all on the same space station having very different experiences of that space station. And it was just one of those things where you feel like, even though you're reading a novel, you do feel like you're learning about what it would really truly feel like to
To be
be
in
in that
the
space. Yeah. Like, I
space
would,
station.
if she was like, if it turned out that she was a former astronaut, I would, that wouldn't surprise me. One of the things that I still remember from it that I looked up afterward and confirmed that it's true was one of the characters' hero is this guy, Sergei Krikalev, who was stuck on Mir for 311 days when the Soviet Union fell.
Oh my
Because
God.
he was up there
There
when that happened, and there was just
was
no
no Soviet Union to bring him back.
to bring him back. So he was just
Oh my
stuck on the
God.
space station for 10 months.
Wow. And how's he how did he do after that?
He loved it.
How are his bones?
He did. I mean, he stayed in the space program and taught everybody how to live in space,
Wow.
so
What a
he learned
baller.
something really great, I guess. But it's one of these books that you really do learn some stuff. One of the things that I felt like reading this book is It just sounds horrible. Like if you want to go to space, if you want to go to Mars for some reason, read this book and let the nightmare of what they think of as like a fun part of their reality.
So this book did not make you want to go to space.
Not at all. No.
Did you want to go before you read it?
No. I mean, it just reinforced that it's good to stay earthbound, and like people who are trying to get us to Mars, should not be trusted by any
Oh
means.
yeah, absolutely. If there's any takeaway from this episode, it's that people who are trying to get us to Mars should not be trusted.
Exactly. That's what we made this
Came here to do.
episode to do. But we really came, no, we what we came here to do is to talk about and sell you all on, and I hope we've done it. Go and buy 50 Beasts to Break Your Heart. It is a really excellent story collection. I feel like it sits very comfortably on the shelf next to those heroes of yours.
Ugh.
And they are
Sorry, that
some
was
of
an
my absolute
involuntary
favorites.
sound.
So it really, if you're a fan of those writers, I really think that you're gonna enjoy this. There's so many great stories in here. And I'm so glad that you could come on and talk to me about it. And to the folks, to all you listeners, you should, support the show on Patreon, patreon.com/smbb. You get special episodes of the show that are just for the listeners that pay on Patreon. You get the book club. At this point, we have chosen the March book title. I don't know what it is yet. You can be part of that choosing process if you're on the Patreon. So come on and join. You can do it for $1. If you join, you get a sticker and a bookmark in the mail. That's always fun. And that's it. And go see Generous if she's in your town, because she puts on a show even if it's despite herself at this point.
That should be my tagline. Puts on a show even if it's despite herself.
Thanks again
Thanks
for coming on. This has been awesome.
for having me. It's always a blast.